I'm Stephanie Wilson, and you're listening to Freedom Over Fascism.
When the situation happened and the news first broke about the 10-year-old victim who had to leave Ohio and come to Indiana for healthcare, my biggest surprise about that situation was how shocked everyone else was. All of us who provide abortion care specifically, but even obstetric care, have taken care of preteen patients. We've all taken care of that particular population of patients, and it's just not that rare. And it's tragic, and it's horrifying, and it's shocking every time, but it's not particularly rare.
Hi, friends. Earlier this fall, I spoke to Dr. Katie McHugh, an OBGYN physician and abortion provider in Indiana. Since then, Ohio voters have approved a measure to enshrine abortion rights and other reproductive rights in their constitution. In August 2022, Kansas voters similarly chose to keep abortion legal. Michigan voters enshrined abortion rights in their constitution in 2022. And in 2023, the Michigan legislature passed a series of laws repealing abortion restrictions. Kentucky voters also rejected further restrictions to abortion in 2022. This affirms what we already knew. When voters have the choice about reproductive freedom, they choose to protect abortion and reproductive rights. When MAGA politicians have the sole lawmaking authority, they take away the freedom for people to make their own reproductive health decisions. In MAGA's Project 2025, their plan for destroying democracy if Trump or another Republican wins the presidency, their very first, quote, promise is to remove reproductive freedom nationwide. This is their promise, and we need to work tirelessly to make sure they can't keep it. So here's what we know. Even in what seems to be the reddest states, when voters have the opportunity to expand reproductive freedom, they choose to enshrine abortion access into law. Unfortunately, many states, including Indiana, have no legal way for citizens to vote on ballot initiatives. We also know health outcomes for women are drastically worse in states that ban abortion. According to the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, in states with abortion bans, maternal mortality can be twice as high as in states where abortion is legal. And also, basic reproductive health care becomes more scarce and more dangerous if abortion is banned. Since Dobbs took away the federal constitutional right to abortion, women experiencing miscarriage do not receive the care they need and often have to wait until they're almost dead before receiving care. I say all of this to reinforce the importance of fighting for the freedoms to be healthy and safe. We need to be talking to our friends who don't pay that much attention to politics and urging them to become more involved. We need to be reaching out to people who rarely vote and bring them into the polls to vote for candidates at every level who stand for real individual freedom and not just give it Orwellian lip service. Now, I want to give you a preview of what you can expect from this podcast next year. I'll be talking with state legislators across the country about the freedom agenda and talking about how we can operationalize this messaging. I'll be talking to candidates for all levels of public office. I'll talk to activists across the country who are working to preserve or reclaim freedoms. And I'll talk to authors and scholars about what is really going on in our moment in history and how we can use their insights to reclaim freedom for all Americans. Before my conversation with Dr. Katie McHugh, which was originally recorded in September 2023, I'd like to ask for your support. Please subscribe to HoosierVictoryAlliance.substack.com or patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. I could really use the support to keep bringing you this podcast where I fill all the production roles without any pay beyond what you provide. Thank you, and may your December holidays be full of the light we're drastically missing in the world today. Now for my conversation with Katie McHugh. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Katie McHugh, a board-certified OBGYN and an abortion provider, chronic pain specialist, and patient advocate. She is currently licensed in 3 states, Indiana, Ohio, and Maryland, and travels to provide abortion care in various locations in these states to provide compassionate, trauma-informed, patient-empowering abortion care. While the work is technically difficult and logistically challenging, she says it is the most meaningful and rewarding part of her professional life. Advocacy is also an integral part of Dr. McHugh's motivation to be a physician, and she's active on social media as a visible physician advocate for reproductive rights and health equity. Her reach as a physician extends far beyond the individual patient in the exam room. Dr. McHugh is a queer, cis woman who delights in her 2 teenage children, is lucky to be partner with an incredible woman. Hi, Katie. Welcome to Freedom Over Fascism.
I am so thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're here too. So I wanted to talk today. It's been a really difficult month, year, 2 years, almost decade. This month, the ban on abortion in Indiana has really gone into effect, as well as bans in South Carolina and a bunch of other states across the country. So can you talk a little bit about what it's like on the ground in practice? Tell me a little bit about your practice and what you do.
I do lots of different things. I'm a board certified OBGYN, and I have lots of interests, as people who go into OBGYN often do. We like to do lots of things and take care of people across the lifetime. So we take care of kids and right before they get their period and as they're going through puberty. And we take care of people who are after menopause, who are experiencing, you know, symptoms like that. And then we take care of people all through various pregnancy journeys. And so my practice reflects that. And since the ban has gone into effect in Indiana, the part of my practice that is dedicated to providing abortion care has changed dramatically. So instead of being able to provide this very safe, very evidence-based care, instead, I have spent that time sending people out of state and helping to coordinate that care with someone else and in different clinics. So it's been devastating to have those conversations with patients. They come in and they say, but I, you know, my sister had an abortion here, or my neighbor was just here last month. And I am like, yep, so was I. I was here last month too. And we were able to provide that care last month, but now it's illegal. So now we have to send you to Ohio or Michigan or Illinois or somewhere else to get this just very normal healthcare. So patients are bearing the brunt of this, of course, but it is also important to talk about the logistical impact of the people who work in this space. You know, I am very mobile. I can get a job in lots of places, but the people who work at the front desk and answer the phones and do all the scheduling, this is their full-time job, and they're constantly in danger of losing their job, which means that the access to even getting out of state is threatened. It's just such an oppressive move to ban abortion in so, so many ways that I'm sure we'll get into.
Right. And it's not like it's a rare procedure. A quarter of American women have had an abortion.
Yes.
Just like a quarter of American women or more have miscarriages, which gets intertwined a lot in terms of the care that you need to provide.
Absolutely. In many cases, it's exactly the same care to provide treatment after a miscarriage or care around abortion. So it is the same care with the same tools, the same medications, exactly the same in many, many cases, especially in the first trimester. So it does get very confusing, but you're right that it is so common. Abortion is common and it is normal. One of the ways that I find reframing conversations around abortion to be very helpful is to talk about abortion as a family value and as a value that helps communities. It's a community-based value. people make the choice to have an abortion because of their life, because of their family, because of their income or their career plans or their own health. These are decisions that are not made selfishly or lightly. These are decisions that are made in the context of someone's life and experience, as well as their whole community. So abortion is very, very much intertwined and almost enmeshed with the idea of community health, of family health and survival, and of supporting the family that already exists.
Right. And so when you cut off that option, you are forcing families to into a life that they maybe can't support. You know, one of the biggest cases that got the most headlines at the beginning after Dobbs was the 10-year-old who came from Ohio to Indiana to get an abortion. There are articles all the time about these young girls who get pregnant and, you know, need to either find a way to get their care or give birth or, you know, have problems in the middle. How have you seen that? Do you see a lot of those kinds of patients, or have you talked to a lot of colleagues where this has really changed the way they're able to provide care to younger girls?
When the situation happened and the news first broke about the 10-year-old victim who had to leave Ohio and come to Indiana for healthcare, my biggest surprise about that situation was how shocked everyone else was. All of us who provide abortion care specifically, but even obstetric care, have taken care of preteen patients. We've all taken care of that particular population of patients, and it's just not that rare. And it's tragic and it's horrifying and it's shocking every time, but it's not particularly rare. So when we take away such an important part of healthcare options for people who have already been so profoundly victimized, right, and we force them into a path which will completely change the course of their life, no matter what happens, no matter if the family decides to keep the infant in the family, if the family chooses adoption, no matter what happens, that child, that preteen pregnant person, is at significantly more health risks simply because of their age. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, as all of us grownups know, pregnancy changes your body. It fundamentally changes the way that your body works and functions and looks and all of that. And, you know, no amount of sit-ups will change that. And And so when we force these children to undergo that, to me, that is the greatest tragedy that there could possibly be, is to just cut off someone's potential like that, who had other options, who had a choice, and then we took that choice away from them.
Well, the juxtaposition between the rhetoric around family values and being pro-life, I mean, obviously, it isn't about life. It isn't about caring for people. It is about accruing more power. I say this all the time on this podcast, is how do we find the most vulnerable populations so that we can find a way to be cruel to them, and multiple different vulnerable populations. So the other side spends so much time trying to help these people that they don't notice the different groups are fighting against each other. So they don't notice that we're taking all the power and we're taking all the money, and they're going to be left without very many rights at all. And we were talking a little bit before we started recording about how intertwined a lot of these things are. And even in Alabama, they use the Dobbs decision as legal reasoning to cut off care for trans kids.
Yes.
And it's intimately intertwined.
Yes, absolutely true. And I, as a fan and a listener of this podcast, I so appreciate the takes that you and your guests often have, which is to name that oppression and name that stealing away of power and resources from the most vulnerable, the most oppressed populations. And in this case, when we talk about abortion, you are absolutely right that it is fundamentally intertwined with the rights of all the other oppressed populations. One of the ways that we see that is in maternal mortality rates. So we see that, you know, maternal mortality rates across the board increase in areas or states that don't have access to safe and legal abortion. But we see that those rates skyrocket for marginalized and oppressed populations like Native American people, like Black women, like Indigenous, and, you know, all of the people who are not rich and white. Those are the people who are oppressed, and they are being literally killed because of these laws and bans. And yet they are the least able to mount a giant lawsuit, to be able to take on the government, because they're just trying to get by. They're literally just trying to live through this. And many times they're not able to live through this.
And it compounds with all of the other pieces, you know, with maternal mortality being much higher for Black women, for example, no matter their socioeconomic status.
Yes.
And so you take all those things and they compound, and all of a sudden you've got more inequality. And then you have people who say that health equity is a bad thing, like in St. Joseph County, Indiana. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so we end up in this situation where quite a few people are not being able to get the health care that they need. So there are the immediate effects of the people who can't get abortions when early in pregnancy. But what are the effects sort of later on with the OBGYN population maybe moving, or maybe the university isn't teaching OBGYN in the med school anymore, or particularly people who have dangerous things happen during their pregnancy? Can you talk about some of those more downstream effects?
Yeah. The ripple effect of bans like this, or changes in our legal healthcare, is almost unfathomable. When I try to think about it, it is so far reaching. For example, because there are so many restrictions on an OBGYN's practice here, it is very difficult to convince someone to move to Indiana or stay in Indiana to practice. When you think about the way that Indiana's Attorney General has behaved around the issue of physicians and physician advocacy, it is a scary place to be. It's hard to convince people to subject themselves to that. It is difficult to convince people to come here or stay here when we have such maternity deserts, meaning that there are not labor and delivery units, there are not OBGYN or family practice or anyone who takes care of pregnant people for many counties in surrounding areas. There are just these pockets of care throughout the state and then just deserts elsewhere. And so then we have this subsequent rise in the complexity of healthcare, because people can't access preventative care, they can't get their blood pressure and diabetes under control before they get pregnant. And so they have much more complicated pregnancies as a result of that. We see long-lasting health impact from these diseases and conditions that arise in pregnancy, mm-hmm. like the development of heart conditions and heart disease and long-term organ damage, like of the kidneys, that we can trace all the way back to people's pregnancies and the lack of care during that time frame, during that very, very short but important time frame. So, you know, the lack of forethought around what will happen to the larger population when we target one particular part of healthcare, force people away from and out of our state, and then we're surprised when we have such poor health outcomes, not just in pregnancy, but also in infant mortality and in long-term health and in survivability and lifespan and overall health and wellness of our population. This is not why we go into medicine. You know, those of us who are in medicine, we do not go into medicine so that we can sweep up the catastrophe that the government has caused. We go into medicine because we want to bear witness to people's lives. We want to be a support and a help through difficult moments in people's lives. I am much less interested in being a party to a government that is oppressive and forcing my patients to have inadequate or substandard healthcare simply because one or a few people in the government think that what I do is gross.
And not only do they think it's gross, they think it's their prerogative to impose their ideas, which are generally uninformed and not based in science and not based in reality, on the rest of us. The statistic that you were talking about with the OBGYN deserts, I believe it's a third of the counties in Indiana do not have OBGYN care.
Yes.
Which is astounding. It's absolutely astounding. And it's not just Indiana. It's all over the South and in states that have banned abortion. It's Idaho doesn't have very many OBGYNs yes. left. And the other day, the governor of Indiana said, oh, well, we're not seeing any bad effects. People aren't not choosing to come to Indiana. Well, I think that we might have a little bit of a difference of opinion, and let's wait for some data to come in, because
yes.
how many people are sending their kids to college in Indiana?
Yes. Yes.
Right. So it's college, it's med school, it's jobs. It's, you know, oh, I graduated from IU and I'm a young person now, and I have children somewhere in the next 10 years. Do I stay here? Or do I go somewhere else where mm-hmm. care is better?
Exactly. And do I stay here where there may or may not be someone who is trained to even take care of me in my moment of need and in my moment that will predict my health for the rest of my life? It's crazy.
Right. And I mean, these men, obviously, it's worse with marginalized populations, but even the most privileged person has miscarriages. I had one. Before I had my son, they thought it was ectopic for a while. And we just waited another 24 hours before I had to take methotrexate. But, you know, then I heard somebody in the Congress saying, oh, well, ectopic pregnancies, getting rid of ectopic pregnancies is not abortion. Mm-hmm. So what is the state of ectopic pregnancies? I mean, do you just have to wait until somebody dies, or can you actually take care of them?
Yeah, great question. This is a great question. And, you know, something that has been discussed widely over the last 2 years since mm-hmm. the Texas SB 8 went into effect. And everyone has been talking about, well, you know, how sick does the person need to be before I intervene? You know, in Tennessee, there's some very confusing legal language where people think that they are committing a felony by providing either ectopic care or abortion care. And then they have to prove that they didn't commit a felony, or that it was like worth it, or, you know, medically sound, or whatever it is. This gives people real pause when our literal freedom is at stake. None of us as physicians, none of us would stand by and watch someone die. And at the same time, it feels also ethically ambiguous and challenging when I'm also worried about my ability to not be imprisoned and, you know, not have a felony and, you know, those kinds of things. These are complicated topics. You know, I was talking to someone the other day in Texas about there's new legal language in Texas that's being considered that would exclude ectopic pregnancies from their abortion ban. So it tries to eliminate this confusion. However, the thing that I always come back to here, or in this case, is the fact that it took them 2 years to decide that ectopic pregnancies were dangerous enough for them to exclude this language. And we also know that exclusions within abortion bans are totally fake. Like most people cannot access the care within those exclusions. It is very restricted. It's very difficult. And so, you know, exceptions is an attempt to look like the other side is being reasonable, and instead they are just passing oppressive laws that criminalize pregnancy and pregnancy outcomes. Right. That's all that's happening. And there is no difference in the treatment of ectopics within the legal language. Even trying to carve that out, as you described, it is not always very straightforward when something is ectopic versus a miscarriage versus a very early pregnancy versus, you know, that's why medicine is not done by a robot, because it takes time and it takes judgment and it's, you know, it can be confusing and it depends on what everything is going on. You can't put all of that into a law.
Especially not by people who have no idea what the biology is, no idea what the science is, no idea how to take care of pregnant people. I mean, maybe you could make better laws about healthcare, but not in this way. People get scared when laws passed against people like them in other states. And so it's not necessarily only the law itself that scares people. It's that they don't know what the law is. And if it's happening in a neighboring state, they think it might also pertain to them. So that kind of trauma is added to the mix when you're talking yes. about either LGBTQ plus issues or pregnancy issues.
Yes, absolutely. And they're right to worry about that. We know that there is, you know, mirrored language across the country, that there are nationally organized efforts to ban the existence of people who don't fall into the Judeo-Christian heteronormative mold. And it is a very, very difficult trauma to process because it's so real, you know? It's you can't convince your brain like that it needs to just calm down and take a breath because it's very, very real. And we see the impact in the news every day, in our friends every day. You know, I'm a queer person myself and trying to live a queer life and a joyful life in a state that so blatantly targets me and my family and my friends and my people, it is actively traumatizing all of the time. And so, you know, you find joy outside of those spaces, you find joy within your, you know, chosen little circle. And the same goes for abortion care. You know, we have these little pockets of support and these pockets of hope. And then we leave our pockets of safety and go out into this very dangerous, very triggering world and try to provide the best care we can, provide the best advice we can, and try to make things better, knowing that this is a long battle. This has been a strategic fight from the other side for many decades, and that we are in for many decades worth of fight and trying to both pace ourselves and keep ourselves safe. It's quite a time to be alive.
It is. You traumatize people for so long, and that itself impacts people's health and well-being.
Yes.
And you don't stay healthy if you are under trauma for so long.
Yeah, absolutely true. We know that from studies on childhood stressors. It fundamentally changes people's genetic predispositions for disease states. We know that from studying people who have been in very stressful situations as adults, like war zones or long-term prison, or it's, you know, other kinds of high stress situations. And we know that those folks have worse health outcomes. They are sicker, they get sicker faster. And that is going to be the case for all of the people within populations who are oppressed. And then, of course, you expand that, and all of us have something about us that's different. All mm-hmm. of us do. We all have something that makes us slightly different, slightly unique, slightly special. And at some point, that's going to be the thing that is targeted. And the lack of understanding or empathy or being able to zoom out and see that bigger picture, that never fails to astound me.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that people who can't do that have always been in a position of privilege so much mm-hmm. that they can't conceive of what it's like to not be white and straight and Christian. Even the idea of Judeo-Christian is actually inaccurate, because Judaism has a very different view. Abortion.
You're completely right.
Right?
Yeah.
And those Christian nationalists have no more use for Jews than they do for LGBTQ people, as they yes. do for people of color, as they do, right?
It's yes, all you're absolutely about the, right. Thank you for correcting me on that. Absolutely, yes.
But I think it's those people who either somewhere in their own history or in the history of people they know who have had those sorts of traumas and have had that sorts of oppression can empathize, and not saying that I have walked in anybody's shoes of color or who is LGBTQ or anybody except my own, but I can very clearly see, as a historian, I can see the historical reverberations through time. You can see how they say history rhymes, but, you know, pretty close to repeating itself in some places. And so I think the only people who really don't see it are people who have never experienced anything besides being a member of the dominant group in whatever place that they are. So one of the things I've heard in recent conversations is that there are groups who help people in states like Indiana and across the South on both abortion care and on trans medical care. And one of those is called Elevated Access. And that's people with private airplanes who volunteer their time and their airplane to fly people free of charge to other places where they can get the care that they need. And I just learned about this. And I know there are other ways to get out of the states that forbid what they need. Can you talk about anything else that you know about that people might like to learn about?
Absolutely. So these organizations are a critical stopgap. So they are a critical band-aid. They are not a fix. The fix is this long-term change of our, you know, legislative and legal systems, et cetera. But these organizations are really stepping up and coming through for individual patients right now while bans are in effect and while these individual people are being so actively harmed. So, you know, in Indiana, one of the organizations we work with a lot is called Midwest Access Coalition, and they work with Elevate as well. Midwest Access is an organization that doesn't provide funds for the actual abortion care. They work with abortion funds for that, but they fund all of the other things. So they fund the transportation, the lodging, the meals, the childcare. They'll help with lost wages, and they arrange all of those things as well. So, for example, I also volunteer with them as a driver in Indiana. So I will, you know, drive up to, I don't know, let's say Lafayette, which is an hour and a half or so from my house. I'll pick someone up and then I will take that person to another place where either they are able to get their abortion care or someone else picks them up and takes them another leg of their journey. So, you know, it's all of these moving pieces and it's all volunteer. You know, none of us are paid or reimbursed or any of that stuff. We are committed to helping the individual people as well as fighting for the future of our society with the legal aspect of this. So these kinds of organizations, and these organizations exist all over the country. There are so many of these organizations and of the abortion funds that are coming through and stepping up and doing everything possible to try to help people get healthcare. It is beautiful and inspiring to see the way that communities come together like this across state lines and across, you know, these fairly large geographic divides to just help one person get the care that they need.
Yeah. And it's also utterly heartbreaking that it's necessary.
Yes, absolutely. And yes.
I was listening to a podcast last year about somebody from the UN talking about the human rights crisis in the United States, and hearing that is just like a, it's kind of like one of the, you know, when a record player back in the day, you scratch, you know, like
scratch.
That we in the United States, feeling as exceptional as we always do, have a human rights crisis on our hands. And as much as we fool ourselves that we're not an empire, we fool ourselves that we have a democracy, we fool ourselves about a lot of things, but fooling ourselves that we are, to the rest of the world, a place where there is a human rights crisis, is a game changer for me. And I'm already in the game. Mm-hmm. Right? I am all in the game. I have adopted Indiana. I live, as listeners know, in Massachusetts. I don't get paid for what I do, although I am really trying to make that happen. But it's unbelievable that that's how the rest of the world, and I already know they look at us like that for the guns, right? Mm-hmm. You know, somebody just asked about, oh, is Ecuador safe to travel to? And I kind of perked up because I actually get to go to the Galapagos next year. But then I thought, okay, it might be a little bit unsafe, but I'm probably less safe going to Texas between the guns and the COVID and the whatever, than anywhere else. This is an active war zone, you know?
Right. Absolutely. And when you think, when you add the capability of pregnancy onto that, and like, what would you do if you were pregnant and you had an issue in a place that doesn't prioritize your health and well-being, that would force you to, you know, to take your life into your hands just by traveling into that state? I'm constantly thinking about that when I'm talking to patients who are traveling, when I'm talking to people who are considering pregnancy and they're moving. I just want to like, make sure you have plan B, make sure you have that, you know, make sure that you have all your ducks in a row so that you can take care of yourself, because you cannot always trust your state to take care of you.
Right. But I see people who are sending their kids to places where just life is so incredibly difficult. And I'm thinking, okay, I hope you got her an IUD and that you have a plane ticket ready to go and that they really understand what the consequences are, because I don't think that people who aren't in the fight every day really think about things like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I also think about that in the context of the people like me who live in these places. Yes. You know, my family is here. I grew up here. Like, this is my home. And even though it is dangerous for me to live here, it is not particularly like career pleasant. I don't know what the right word is. Like, it's not a great place for me to practice my craft that I've spent my life developing. But this is my home and my neighbors are my family, and the people who live here and are from here also deserve rights and healthcare and respect and all of that. So it is also so difficult to consider leaving when I see my people here. These are my people. And so I feel that very strongly when I look, because my kids are also growing up and we're getting close to the college age, et cetera. And I'm thinking about where, you know, I would love for them to stay close because I adore them and want to see their faces. I would love for them to study in Europe, where I know that if they get into an accident, that they are not going to be bankrupt because of their healthcare bills. You know, I would love for the world to be a safe and comfortable and welcoming place for everyone everywhere. And I know that that is the most Pollyanna thing to say, but it is the way that the world could be. And it is the way that I believe we should work toward, because the way that we currently have arranged ourselves and our resources is clearly not sustainable. It is clearly not working. So we have to choose a better way, and we have to work together to get there.
Absolutely. And I think that that is a good way to end this, is that we have to work together and we have to have a vision, a shared vision of what that looks like. And that looks like freedom to be able to make your own medical decisions and be able to pay for it, and the ability to have a job and be able to be home on time to put dinner on the table.
Yes.
And the ability, right, to be able to take out, to go to the library and have your teen go to the teen section and find teen books.
Yes.
Right.
And not be worried that they're going to get shot on the way.
Exactly.
Or that the air quality is too bad for you to walk to the library because of, you know, all the industry. Yes, absolutely agree.
The way that the other side, which I beg everybody to stop calling conservative, because they are not conserving anything. They are trying to radically change the way our country is governed and thinks of itself. They just tell themselves that it's opposite world. Like, that's what they want too. And the people who want clean air, they're crazy. And the people who think the climate is changing despite a hurricane in Los Angeles and fires in Hawaii and no winters in New England. And so they just lie to themselves and everybody else. And that's not sustainable either. And hopefully we will come to our collective senses, come together and make the world that we know could be possible.
Yes, I agree. And I am glad to be in this fight with you. Thank you for all that you do.
I'm glad to be in this fight with you too. I'm so excited that you were able to come, and just thank you for your time.
Thanks for listening. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. We thank you for choosing freedom over fascism.